Search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 8th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana-Champaign. We've got a great show for you today. I think many of our listeners, based on the calls and the feedback I get, think that a lot of what passes for news today in the news media is bull. And our guest today has written a book telling us how to identify bias in junk journalism and what we can do about it. It should be a wonderful show, so I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guest in our program today, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. The U.S. Postal Service's recent proposal to hike postal rates has small print publications and news outlets worried for their future. The USPS is asking the Postal Regulatory Commission to approve emergency rate increases in order to help offset a $7 billion deficit. But the rate increases may put dozens of independent and alternative print publications in jeopardy. Teresa Stack, publisher of The Nation, said that this is the third price hike to hit periodicals since 2007. She estimates that the magazine would face an additional $200,000 in postage fees, not an easy amount to make up. Stack worries that some publications may have to close up shop.
So for small magazines like us, it's an incredible burden. And this is at the same time that journalism is in a crisis overall because of the collapse of advertising, because of the move to free content on the Internet. So I anticipate that a lot of magazines are just going to close their printed versions, if not close their doors entirely, because there's still no workable model on the Internet to sort of pay the cost of journalism.
With so many local newspapers already closing their doors or making drastic cuts, the postal rate increases could leave the country with even fewer voices and alternatives for news. And while some may see this as simply another natural progression toward an online media landscape, Stack noted that most investigative journalism starts in print publications before it resurfaces on the web.
I think you're definitely going to see a decrease in the amount of quality journalism that's fact-checked and professional and available to the general public. There's no doubt in my mind that the Internet is going to become a less vibrant place and that people are going to not have access to the kind of information that they have now.
Stack said the Postal Service, no longer receiving any federal support, has moved away from its original mission to help disseminate information to the people.
The sort of founding fathers who set up the Postal Service over 200 years ago did so because they felt that it was essential to like a functioning democracy, to have this kind of information available to every citizen in the country. So what you have now is a Postal Service that's trying to run itself absolutely strictly as a business. And if it runs its business, then the effect of that is to make some of these news organizations, or many of these news organizations, have to close their doors. I mean, that's just a historic betrayal of its mission.
And now, a special commentary by Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver.
For years, Internet advocates have warned of the doomsday scenario that will soon play out. Google and Verizon will announce a deal that the New York Times reports could allow Verizon to speed some online content to Internet users more quickly if the content's creators are willing to pay for the privilege. The deal marks the beginning of the end of the Internet as you know it. Since its beginnings, the net was a level playing field that allowed all content to move at the same speed, whether it's ABC News or your cousin's video blog. That's all about to change, and the result couldn't be more bleak for the future of the Internet, for television, radio, and independent voices. How did this happen? We have a Federal Communications Commission that has been denied authority by the courts to police the activities of Internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast. We have a pro-industry FCC chairman who's terrified of making a decision, conducting backroom deal-making, and willing to sit on his hands rather than reassert his agency's authority. We have a president who promised to take a backseat to no one on net neutrality, yet remains silent. We have a Congress that's nearly completely captured by industry. Yes, more than half of the U.S. Congress will do pretty much whatever the phone and cable companies ask them to. Add the clout of Google, and you have near complete control of Capitol Hill. A non-neutral internet means that companies like AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, and Google will control what information comes to us and how. They will control what we can share with the world and what we can't. This Google-Verizon deal, this industry-captured FCC, and the way this is playing out is akin to the largest banks writing the regulatory policy on derivative trading without any oversight or input from the public and having it rubber-stamped by the SEC. It's like BP and Halliburton ironing out the rules for offshore oil drilling with no public input and having MMS sign off. Fortunately, while they're outnumbered, there are several powerful net neutrality champions on Capitol Hill. But they will not be able to turn this tide unless they have the massive, visible support from every American who uses the internet. Tell your representatives that you're not letting the internet go the way of big oil and big banks. The future of the internet and your access to information depends on raising your voice.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 8th, 2010. Our guest today is a former journalist, an award-winning journalist, and a media scholar and journalism professor from the Bay Area. John McManus has written countless articles and two superb and award-winning books. At least one of them is award-winning. I hope the other one will be, too. 1994's Market-Driven Journalism, Let the Citizen Beware, which was one of the foundational books in understanding the current plight of journalism of recent decades. And then the brand new book he's written, which we'll be talking about today, Detecting Bull, How to Identify Bias and Junk Journalism in Print, Broadcast, and on the Wild Web. John McManus, thank you for taking time to join us.
My pleasure, Bob, and I can tell you with pleasure that Detecting Bull also won the Society of Professional Journalists Prize for Research in 2009.
Well, congratulations. You're two for two.
I'm two for two.
That's a good batting average.
It is. Not very productive, but what comes out has at least gotten some favorable recognition from some folks.
Well, John, let's talk a little bit about your background before we get into the details of the book so people know your experience and where you're coming from. You began, as I understand, as a journalist?
Yeah, I was a reporter, a newspaper reporter, and primarily working in the southeastern U.S. Because the problem that I most wanted to address was racism. So I wanted to tell stories that weren't being told that might dent some of the myths, particularly around race, and try to right some injustices in that area, which were very severe at the time and still endure.
And then you left journalism as a reporter at what time?
I left journalism in 1982 to pursue a question that struck me while I was being a journalist. I kept running into this wall that I hadn't been prepared by my education to face of the economic self-interest of the news organization for which I worked. And no matter which one I worked for, I would be blocked from doing certain stories or told there wasn't time to do certain stories or the readers weren't interested in certain stories that clearly were important matters. For example, in South Carolina, at the time, the textile industry was dominant, and they were combing a lot of cotton, and a lot of their mill workers were getting sick with something called brown lung disease or bisonosis. And it had never appeared in the newspapers. So I wrote a series of stories and explaining the nature of this problem, that it wasn't just because these guys smoked or because they had bad genes or whatever it was that they were dying early. The industry hated the stories and threatened my publisher, who then told me not to write anymore.
And the result of that was Market-Driven Journalism, Let the Citizen Beware, your 1994 book, which really, I think, was instrumental in helping people understand the changes in the news media marketplace and the commercial pressures upon the news.
Yeah, eventually. I think at first it was really rejected in American academe, although praised elsewhere in the world. It was seen as economic reductionism. You know, how dare you think of news as being a business, and that stockholders and shareholders and pressures from advertisers and even from the audience really influence news. That the idea that markets shape news was considered to be really a dumb thought.
I mean, the dominant thought then, John, at that time was that the newsroom was a cocoon protected by professional values and professional journalists, and they really had the power and they made the right decisions?
That's right. That's right. And in a piece subsequently, I've argued that the journalists are much more decision takers than decision makers. It was a Jesse Jackson moment.
Well, I think that book came out in the early 90s, the research for it in the early 90s, published in 94.
Right.
And, I mean, now that looks like a golden age compared to what's happened since then, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The number of reporters then is probably, two to 2.5 times as many as there are now. Many more of them were specialized reporters with deep knowledge. Most newspapers are making 20, 25, and some even in the mid 30% return on gross revenues and on large gross revenues. They were minting money. Television stations were making 50% and up, local TV stations. It was maybe not a golden age for journalism, but it was certainly a resource-rich age for journalism. Even then, of course, you know, there were beginning to be demands from shareholders to squeeze the newsroom for yet greater profits to satisfy Wall Street. But certainly, looking back, that certainly seems to have a golden sheen to it.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John McManus, the author of the new book, Detecting Bull, How to Identify Bias and Junk Journalism in Print, Broadcast, and on the Wild Web, the award-winning new book, Detecting Bull. And John McManus is a longtime journalist, scholar, writer, journalism professor, who wrote the earlier book, Market-Driven Journalism, Let the Citizens Beware. If you'd like to call in and talk with John McManus here on Media Matters, the phone number at WILLAM580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And before we go back to our guest, I do want to apologize. Last week, we had some technical difficulties with our program, and I gather at times it was not an especially pleasurable experience to be at the receiving end. We'll do everything in our power to see that that never happens again. John, I mean, your first chapter, John McManus in Detecting Bull, you go into what you call the sea change in American journalism. And you and I both work in this area. We research it. We've been following it for decades. So to us, this is almost like air, what you talk about. We understand it. It's what we look at every day. I still never cease to be surprised by the number of Americans who are really, to some extent, oblivious to this entire process that's going on with journalism.
Well, I think that no institution, just like no one, wants to call attention to their own deficiencies. And so the news media have covered this to the extent that they have for the general public as a business story. And generally it's been on the local business page or inside the paper, oh, yes, we just cut another 50 journalists or 75 journalists from our staff. We're doing so to improve the quality of the paper, to make it, less bulky or cumbersome, lighter to recycle, all sorts of things. But I think the public the story has not been reported to the general public. And so that first chapter is an attempt to make several points. The first is that after decades of growth, the number of trained journalists paid to supply us reliable information is falling, and in some cases quite drastically. And as those journalists are laid off, the volume and quality and integrity of news is declining. And the new providers are beginning to fill the vacuum, new providers of news. But their reports are all over the map, and there are hidden conflicts. The quality, some are terrible and some are terrific, but the quality is there are hidden conflicts of interest. We're not sure, for whom these new providers actually work. They're not protected as they were in professional newsrooms from at least from some of the influences in the community. They were not as independent. And that spinmeisters are getting better. As a consequence, public trust in journalism is falling, and that's really dangerous for democracy.
John McManus, I just had an old friend of mine from Seattle from the 70s and early 80s come through the Midwest, and we spent an afternoon together. And he's been a reporter for a number of major daily newspapers, and most recently the spokesman, the Spokane Washington Daily Newspaper. And I just asked him in passing, you know, how many reporters were in the Spokane newsroom today compared to, say, 20 years ago, 1990? And he said, he thought about it, and he said probably about half, if that. And that seems to be, from the research I've seen, more or less what the pattern is. There's roughly half the number of working journalists, if that, in pretty much every community in America there was 20, 25 years ago.
You know, in the Bay Area, it's much worse than that. In 2000, just 10 years ago, at the San Jose Mercury News, there were 425 journalists, and now they're probably about 115. At the San Francisco Chronicle, which is the largest paper in Northern California, there were over 500 journalists in 2000, and today there are probably 125.
That's staggering. And I want to add, too, that people say, well, that's just newspapers. That doesn't matter. We can turn on the TV or radio. We're covered. This data includes a lot of the studies. The drop-off has been almost as severe in broadcast news, which started from a much lower point to begin with than did print journalism. But, you know, these are numbers. Again, they're sort of abstract. I mean, what does it mean? You're in the Bay Area. What does it mean in terms of being a resident in the Bay Area, living in Oakland or Berkeley or San Francisco or San Jose? And there is this enormous drop-off in working journalists covering the community. How does that show up tangibly in the life of a citizen? What is the problem there?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because you don't know what you don't know. So there, you know, if you have one quarter as many journalists covering things, snooping around, checking on things, trying to figure out what's going on in the community, you're not going to learn nearly as much as you did when there was the full complement. But you're not aware of what scandals are not being reported of. But what you are aware of is that the remaining content seems to be more commercialized. The fattest sections of the paper are really advertising about buying cars or real estate or the nightlife of the community or sports. And there's less and less about news of civic consequence. So it is difficult to measure what we've lost. Certainly, you know, you don't see coverage of local city councils. You don't see coverage of local schools. You don't see, unless, of course, some sort of scandalous thing occurs, such as a principal being caught with kiddie porn on his computer. So we know much less about the workings of our community than we did just 10 short years ago.
Our guest, John McManus, author of the new book, Detecting Bull. Please call us at WILL if you have a question or comment for John McManus at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. John, one of the things that seems that you write about in the book that has come to play an oversized or outsized role in journalism in the United States seems to be crime news. And this is something that when I talk to audiences and talk to students that everyone gets. And just for the heck of it, I just did an informal survey. I went to a handful of cities and looked at their home pages of their daily newspapers in the cities. And I was really struck in almost every case how what a high percentage of the stories in the local news were like, you know, local man kills wife and cuts off foot, you know, guy goes nuts and punches his dog and shoots a cat. These sort of crime stories, almost an entire absence of political stories.
Yeah, I think crime stories and maybe sports and celebrity or just the unusual have become even more a staple than they used to be. And it used to be that local TV was famous for that. But now newspapers, I agree. I see many more episodic sort of focus on, you know, a single event story told in a powerful human interest way that attracts your attention. And I think there's a reason for that. And that is much of, if not all of the reporting is done for the news organization by police agencies. So they find out, you know, who, what, why, when, where, and all you have to do is ask the, you know, the official there.
So ironically, if I can interject, this is sort of government-subsidized journalism.
In that respect, yeah. It's also, I mean, it's what I would call perfect market-driven journalism in that it doesn't offend advertisers. It's cheap to gather. It's sort of one-stop shopping or reporting. You go to the scene of the crime. If you're lucky, you get there quickly by listening to your scanner radio. You can get the crying, you know, mother or friend of the victim, the person saying, I can't believe this happened. You get all that pathos and emotion. You have the cop there who can tell you something about what took place. You've got dramatic visuals if it's television or on the web. So you've got all these elements of a story that cost almost nothing to gather and doesn't take much skill to put together or to write or to report. And it also generalizes well. It sells across the market. Anybody with a heart is touched by a story like that, whereas a political story, even about a major city in, say, a metropolitan area, you know, we'll say something that happens at city council in a major city like San Francisco, that doesn't matter much to people who live outside that city who comprise much of the audience for these mass media. So it's perfect in terms of its benefit-to-cost ratio. It generates a large audience at very little price, and it doesn't offend advertisers. So it's, from an economic perspective, it's a wonderful thing. From a social perspective, though, I think it's quite less than that, because knowing a lot about a few cases where there's, you know, a few cases of lurid crime probably makes us afraid, but it doesn't really inform us. It doesn't tell us, you know, are things getting safer or more dangerous in our community. It may make us fear minorities because the focus is always on violent crime, no white collar crime. It distracts us, I think, more than it engages us with what we need to know.
John McManus, our guest today, the author of Detecting Bull. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters coming to you live on WILL AM 580. And John, the question I'm about to ask you might sound like a rhetorical question, but it's actually a very serious question because, like you, I teach college-age kids, and I have children and teenagers and college-age kids, and I talk to their friends a lot. And, you know, for this generation, for a lot of them, from what I can tell, certainly compared to our generation, and I think you and I are roughly the same era, for this generation, I don't get the sense that news, as you and I have understood it, plays a very significant role in their lives, that if they go many days without seeing what we would consider news, it doesn't really notice them. I mean, I subscribe to 3 daily newspapers, and, you know, I think my kids and their friends would just climb over them before they'd actually pick one up and read them. And how do you explain to a young person who says, I don't need this stuff anymore? That's all. That's 20th century. That's throwback. That doesn't apply to the world I'm living in today. What do you say to them to say, no, journalism's important?
Yeah, I basically say if you snooze, you lose in a democracy because everything's up for grabs. And there are powerful interests who are grabbing for it. And if you don't not just pay attention but also organize with your peers, you're going to be facing a very difficult future. And I think we've already seen this. The fact that young people have been disengaged now for some time from the news, I think, is leading to negative consequences for them. You know, young people disproportionately bear the brunt of war, and we're now involved in 2 wars overseas. They will pay off this enormous debt that those wars have created, as well as the recession brought on by the lack of regulation of Wall Street. So the fact that they weren't paying attention, weren't voting in numbers, were not making their voice heard, doesn't mean that the halls of government and influence was silent. It just means that their voice was missing. And if you look at the debt that's being piled up on them because of these things being paid for with credit cards, you know, such as these wars and the effort to climb out of this recession, they will pay very dearly for their lack of attention. So I argue it's in their self-interest because power is exercised, whether you are part of it or not. And if you're not part of it, then it's often exercised on you rather than with you.
And then the follow-up, though, that comes back from the smarter of the young people that I have that conversation with is, okay, let's pick up the morning paper and take a look at what you're talking about as news. And it's just what you described. It's some guy shoots two goats in his backyard. It's some story about a celebrity getting a butt lift. It's this sort of gibberish. They say, why exactly do I need to know this?
Yeah. Well, that's when I say, look, the web is a big place, and I direct them to higher quality news operations, which unfortunately, at least now, are mostly at the national level, things like the New York Times, the Washington Post, serious web outlets. It's a problem at the local level, though, because that is the focus. I think that what needs to happen is people need to get together and confront newsrooms and say, look, this is not acceptable. We're not as dumb as you think we are. We need higher quality news. That argument is harder to make now than it probably has ever been in our lifetimes, because news is the ownership is more concentrated than it's ever been. In the San Francisco Bay Area, home to Ben Bagdikian, who warned for years about media monopolies, we now have a situation where every paid paper except one, from Santa Rosa to the north of San Francisco down to Monterey in the south, is owned by the same company.
And this is a region of, what, 8 million people, 7 million people?
It's about 7.5 million people. And the only paper that's not owned by Media News, Dean Singleton's operation, is the San Francisco Chronicle, and that probably will be owned by him within a year or two. So we've had this clustering of ownership, and they've cut back these newsrooms to the bone in order to generate money to pay off the debt that Mr. Singleton has taken on, buying one newspaper after another, often at bargain prices, but still sucking all this money out of the newsroom in order to buy more papers to expand the empire. So, what to do about it is the most difficult question I think you could ask me. But I think a start is to go to newsrooms and to call them on the schlock that they're putting out and demand more substance. And you can't do this alone. I would love to see journalism schools using some of the tools in Detecting Bull, for example, to rate the quality or the bias in news, because the standards used there are the same ones that they use in the newsroom. So you're basically speaking their language. And to go in and say, look, why do we have to read about all these weird episodic stories or these lurid crime stories when so many more important things are happening?
Our guest today in Media Matters, John McManus, you've just been listening to, journalist, media scholar, journalism professor based out of the Bay Area, author of the brand new book, Detecting Bull, How to Identify Bias in Junk Journalism and Print Broadcast and on the Wild Web, the award-winning new book, I might add. If you have questions or comments you'd like to get John McManus' feedback on or answer to, the number here, 333-9455, or the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with John McManus.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So this is a story I think has not been covered all that well, and you guys can comment on it, certainly. To start, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just reported that the planet has gone through the warmest decade, the warmest year, the warmest 6 months, the warmest April, May, and June on record. Nine nations have just set all-time temperature records. Russia, Niger, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, 130 degrees. A Canadian study has said that since 1950, the phytoplankton, which is the base of the marine food chain, has decreased by 40% since 1950. And then the Senate just decided not to do anything on any kind of climate legislation. And so I guess I would, say that, mainstream media covering this story, it's a pretty big story, I think. And are we doing like a Thelma and Louise moment where we're just going to sail off live in this new atmosphere that we're creating? So that would be my, I think it's a huge story. And how does the media and the news services eventually help people to understand this? I said this, I told a friend of mine this the other day. He's just told me that he had just finished reading Atlas Shrugged for the second time. His response to it was, well, you know, there's not a lot of astronomer sciences that are reporting on this. So to him, it has no merit. So I'll get off and listen to you guys. I'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And John McManus, this issue, I think, goes directly to the heart of what you're writing about in Detecting Bull, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this is a great example.
Yeah, so please, and you also, if I might add, have some experience with science journalism, which has been one of the areas that's been most devastated by the commercial cutbacks in newsrooms.
Yeah. I think a lot of those specialist reporters, I was a medical science writer, those people are the ones that are first to go and are moving more towards a general assignment kind of approach where reporters don't have deep knowledge, which they really need to do a good job. But to get back to the caller's question, you have very informed listeners. That was a nice, concise statement of the peril that we're in, and I think it is a Thelma and Louise moment. And the media, those are the kinds of issues and stories that are being displaced by the lurid front page crime story, or the overemphasis on sports or celebrities, or just the bizarre and the unusual. And people are not, you know, if I think the media were fulfilling their professional responsibility to help us make sense of those issues and events that have the greatest impact on our lives, then clearly they would be really pushing. You'd see lots and lots of stories on climate change and on what could be done about it and what are the obstacles and how they could be circumvented. That would be a constant theme on the front page, never absent for more than, you know, a week or so on the front page. And people, don't know much about it, and they're not pressuring Congress. And the business industry is loudly proclaiming that, well, this might cause us some short-term taxes or losses or diminishment of profit, and so it's a terrible thing. And they're rallying, people who have no trust in science. And so there are forces that are putting pressure on Congress. Unfortunately, they're not us, not the people who are slowly cooking like the frogs in the proverbial pot.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is also evidence when it has been reported on, it shows the problem that the press has with its sort of false objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
This concept that every argument ought to have two sides and that there is a balance between them. And so we talk to someone who, you know, we talk to one side, it may have 95% of the scientists on its side, and the other side has, 5%. And we treat them as if they're equally competing voices, sort of he said, she said journalism. And the public is confused.
And John, if I can just interject another part of your story that I think fits in, invariably in those 95 to 5% splits, the 5% is backed up by a lot of money. If all the money's on the 95% side, the 5% is not going to get heard.
Yeah, that's right. But the press presents it with this false idea of balance, as if, it's an open scientific dispute and there really is no consensus and, you can choose either side. And since one side involves very painful decisions and taxes, we should choose the other. So there's, this false notion of balance and objectivity that journalists kind of hide behind because it allows them to gain access to all sides, to any contentious issue without taking a side, without taking a stand. So what happens, I think, is they substitute accurately quoting both sides for truth. And the goal of journalism is truth, not stenography, not just taking down what special interests on one side say and what people on the other side say. It's to try to find out who has the better evidence and to present it clearly enough that the public has information upon which they can act.
You know, John, this gets to something that's at the heart of your book, Detecting Bull, and that really the issue that concerns a lot of our listeners, I know, which is that, you know, for example, I write periodically for The Nation magazine, and I've had the privilege a couple of times of being on Bill Moyer's program. And I know from personal experience, anything I've written for that magazine or anytime I've been on Bill Moyer's show, literally every sentence I say or write is fact-checked. And I have to come up with hard evidence to back up every single claim, or else they won't run it. They'll edit it out. And one of the things that's striking about journalism today, both print and especially broadcast, is the lack of factual accuracy that seems to be all over the place. And you talk about this in terms of truthiness. It seems to be a big part. Am I right that this is a growing phenomenon? And if I'm right or not right, what do we do about it?
Well, yeah, I think it is. I think that, you know, truthiness, of course, is Stephen Colbert's term for BS or bald sophistry. And we have...
Is that what BS stands for? Oh.
I think we're entering an age when, I think as you pointed out in your wonderful new book on the life and death of American journalism, that the number of public relations practitioners has vastly increased in the last 20 years to where they're now, what, they outnumber journalists 3 or 4 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
So people who are paid to make a case for a special interest, for a corporation or a government entity, now outnumber the people who break those cases for the public benefit. And the sophistication that they are showing is, and the ruthlessness and the ethical aspect of it are growing. You know, witness the story the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for last year, where the Bush administration had created a system where they would reward military analysts who were commenting on the Iraq invasion, who spewed the talking points of the administration as if they were independent analysts. They would give them access to officials. They'd give them make sure that they were in line for government contracts. And the official, any type of military expert analyst who didn't follow that, or who stopped following the party line, stopped taking the talking points and repeating them on news programs, would be cut out of this program. So it was kind of a Trojan horse. It was essentially stacking the deck of sources that news organizations use. The news organizations were presenting these people as independent experts when, in fact, they were shills for the administration.
Our guest, John McManus, author of Detecting Bull. If you have a question or comment, the number again, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line one, Champagne. You're on the air.
Hi. I was going to ask the question you just addressed about the practice of stenography as instead of journalism, and that the problem seems to be not a existence of bias, but the we actually probably need more bias in the reporting of journalism. But you sort of talked about that, but I'd like to hear more about it. But could it be that we're headed back with the Internet and something like Fox News to an earlier form of journalism where there really was overt bias? There was a Republican newspaper. There was a Democratic newspaper. And if you read the Republican paper, you got the Republican spin. If you read the Democratic paper, you get the Democratic spin. And now on the Internet, you have the same kind of, I guess, neighborization, where you just have your own personal views reinforced by the journalism or reporting that you're getting, and that maybe that's a healthier situation.
Thank you very much, caller. John McManus, is a sort of a partisan press, as the caller described, maybe have benefits that aren't often understood?
To the extent that it might rally interest in the news, but to the extent that it's biased in a partisan way, particularly if it's an untruthful and misleading way, such as Sarah Palin's calling aspects of the health care reform bill, calling for the establishment of death panels, and the misrepresentation that occurs certainly not helpful. I would argue that the current situation is more toxic than valuable in that regard, because the the people funding these voices on the web that purport to be presenting news are not sort of the competing party so much as they are ideologues, and oftentimes people who are sponsored by organizations that like the Chamber of Commerce or the particular corporations or a trade group or an industry group, and they have a very, very narrow agenda rather than the somewhat wider agenda that even small political parties have. So I think it's not a healthy situation. We're talking about bias. I would argue that journalism ought to have three biases, three what I call positive biases, and only three in its reporting. And the first of those is a bias for the common good, an absolute preference for choosing stories and reporting them in terms of what does the community need to know, and we're going to go out and find that out. And we're going to put pressure on people who don't tell us, and we're going to explore the issues that most affect the community, whether they come up in the news in an event or not. We're going to explore them on our own. We're going to push for answers about these things. And we're going to press them where the answers don't match what the public, the public interest. And I think the public interest is something that news people ought to discuss with the public to get a sense of what is the common good in any community rather than sort of imposing their own view. So the second positive bias, I would argue, is brevity, because people don't have all time, all day to read or watch the news. And so the news, if it's going to be effective for a mass audience, has to condense that material. I think the third positive bias is one towards interestingness. Trying to use all the skills that journalists have in storytelling and photography and videography and creating graphics to make the important interesting, rather than doing what they're doing frequently now, which is making the merely interesting seem important by putting it on the front page or the top of websites and the top of newscasts.
John McManus, when people talk about bias in the news, I think a lot of the talk is about journalists' liberal bias, that they're pro-democratic party, they're liberal politically, and they use their political values to shape the news to be very liberal and pro-democratic and hostile to the Republican Party and conservatism. And this argument is heard most prominently on Fox News, which then uses it as justification to be partisan to sort of balance what it alleges as the liberal bias of working journalists and of media companies against conservatives. Where do you come down on this whole debate about liberal bias and how it takes place and how Fox frames it?
Yeah, I think it's largely a myth. Having worked in a number of newsrooms, the reporters, I think, in general, were liberal. 75% of them, I would say, were more sympathetic to the Democratic Party's ideals than the Republican Party. But they work for a management which tends to be overwhelmingly conservative. And when reporters and management disagree on what ought to be covered, guess who wins? So you work in an organization where the people who control the product tend to be quite conservative. And I think that more than balances out any liberal tendencies among the reporters. Plus, you're working in a structure which is designed to generate profit for its owners. And that is a bias in itself, something called commercial bias. And commercial bias, I think, is probably less offensive to Republicans, although to true conservatives, I think it's equally offensive to how Democrats would perceive it. True conservatives meaning people who really want to conserve the good things that we have and perhaps want a smaller role for government, but not a sort of corporate-controlled government.
John McManus, you talked in your work throughout your career, your published work, but what we've talked about in the program today, too, is some of the conflicts or problems between commercial pressures and sort of what the necessary journalism for a self-governing and free society. And today, with the commercial system really in struggling and collapse, with the decline in resources going to journalism, really quite astonishing in the last few years, Is there in your mind a way out of this using the internet that's going to recreate or create a brand new commercial market for journalism that will provide sufficient resources so we will have school boards and cities covered, and there will be journalists covering the various branches of government and covering corruption and giving citizens the information that you, I think, argue they need to have in order to have a free society?
Well, it's interesting. I just came back from a journalism conference in Denver, the Association for Education in Journalism and Mass Communication. And there were, you know, a number of discussions of this topic and examples of where newspapers, primarily newspapers, but also some TV stations, are desperately trying to find ways to cover things, particularly at the local level, that they no longer have the staff to cover. So these so-called pro-am partnerships where a blogger might be contacted by the newspaper and an arrangement designed between them, signed, that they would try to direct traffic to each other so that the newspaper might take the stories off the blog or take headlines for the stories and substitute it for its local reporting and have these citizen journalists provide that reporting free. Now, they would usually direct people to the websites of the citizen journalist, but they could basically, their hope is to divide up all the neighborhoods in the metropolitan area and recruit or find an existing blogger in each of those areas who will provide some reporting and commentary about those areas. The trouble with that is that it's not financially viable. They really haven't found a way to compensate them, and the quality of that work is amateur because the people doing it are amateurs. And again, some of the amateurs are very good, but many of them are not very good. Many of them are not even familiar with the codes of ethics of journalism and the restrictions on how you tell stories that ensure that they're accurate, the verification standards, for example, or independence or from conflicts of interest. So to go to the larger question, I don't think there's no question that what's out there now in terms of new providers is in any way a substitute in even quantity, much less quality, to the journalism that's been lost. And I personally don't see that happening. I think we undervalue good reporting. It takes intelligence. It takes some background. It takes a willingness to talk to all sides. It takes great skill, I think, in writing or videography or photography and chart making. It takes a doggedness. It takes time. Those are not things that many bloggers or citizen journalists or other amateur journalists really have to devote to it. And oftentimes, these people are trying to sell ads in addition to writing the news. In most news organizations, there at least was some kind of wall, but even now there are different people doing those two functions. And the idea was you didn't want to be influenced in your news writing by who was giving you an ad or who you wanted to take out an ad in your publication or on your website. But now you'd have to be a schizophrenic in order to make that separation. So I don't see the web, and there's no evidence yet that amateur journalists are going to sort of fill in for us and we're going to see this renaissance. The other problem is that the amount of advertising revenue generated on the web is pennies on the dollars for most newspapers compared to print ads, even though print ads are deeply discounted from what they were 10 years ago. So the revenue model is not there. And I agree with you, Bob, in your book, that we are going to have to find a way to subsidize quality journalism now that the folks who have subsidized it for the last century and a half, the retailers, the advertisers, are leaving. And I think that's government's role. I would argue that journalism is the most important public educator next to the public school system, and that unlike the public school system, it's a lifelong educator. And in terms of civic education, it is the most important, bar none. So I would argue that quality journalism is a necessary, although insufficient, cause or condition for democracy flourishing. It's that important. And We made the decision back in the middle of the 19th century to begin requiring children to go to public schools and requiring everyone to pay for them because of the benefits to society. I think the same argument can be made for supporting news. And you've, in your book, which I think is a must-read for people, I think you outline some ways that that might happen without government control over what's in the news.
Well, thank you very much, John, for those kind words.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of people at AEJMC about this, and a lot of response was, in the current political environment and economic environment, that's never going to happen, that's unrealistic. I said, it's got to happen. And these ideas, I think, academics, our job is to plant seeds and to make cases for them, and then to hope that the public will pick them up and carry them as far as they merit carrying. So I salute you for having researched that as well as you did in the life and death of American journalism. I think that's the way to go. I don't see an alternative.
Well, John, you just mentioned you were at the Trade Association for Journalism Schools. You're connected to a journalism school. I've taught journalism students for decades now. What is the role of journalism schools in sort of addressing this crisis? Or is there are journalism schools basically the horse and buggy schools of the coming year? I mean, do they have anyone to train for, any jobs to train people for?
It's really interesting that I no longer teach, actually. I was teaching journalism up until a couple of years ago. But there was a demand in the school that I was teaching in to pass through the students through without really challenging them much because they were trying to boost enrollment so they get a greater share of the resources of the university, sort of a market-driven higher education, a book that I'm now researching.
Mm.
To go back to the issue, I don't know why enrollments remain as high as they are. And I think part of it is that journalism educators are not being frank with students about what lies ahead of them. You can imagine why they wouldn't be, because if they were, they might lose a large number of their majors and their jobs subsequently. In terms of what they ought to do, I would like to see, and we're beginning to see a little bit of this, growing news literacy. I would like to see journalism schools teaching a course that would be required or at least an option in the general education curriculum for all college students on the importance of civic engagement and the importance of informed engagement through consumption of quality news, and the ability to discriminate between wheat and chaff in that regard.
You know, John McManus, we've got about 6-7 minutes left, and we haven't really gotten to the heart and soul of your book, Detecting Bull, but I would like to give you a chance now to just talk about the idea of detecting bull. How does someone listening to the show now become, if they haven't a chance to look at your book in the near term, how do they become a more discerning reader, viewer of the news that they see, so they can see what the good stuff is and what the baloney is?
Yeah, well, the thesis of the book is that we're in an era where the news media that we've relied on, such as, newspapers and local TV, network TV, cable television, and their web products, is becoming much less reliable because of the enormous shrinkage of the number of people putting it out. So the traditional media are cutting ethical corners that they wouldn't have done, I think, 10 years ago, and even then they were cutting some corners. But now we're seeing a lot of what I would call commercial bias, a lot of the sensationalism we talked about earlier with the focus on crime and sort of individual cases of crime and sports and celebrities and the unusual. And we're also seeing it in terms of newsrooms where reporters are expected to write 3 stories a day, relying on public relations, not only to point them to what's news, which, of course, allows private interests who are rich enough to have PR departments to set the agenda for the public, but also to report the news. You don't have time to report anymore in many newsrooms, so you just take the press release, put your byline on it, maybe make one more call, and call it your own. And advertising is more and more cropping up as news. And we document those trends in, or I document them in Detecting Bull. So what do you do about it? Well, one other thing, in addition to the deterioration of the news sources that we used to trust, there is this enormous tsunami of new information coming over the web, particularly, and also over cable, additional cable channels, of dubious provenance, where corporations are producing information that looks like news, which is not independent, is not journalism. It's you know, it makes a case for their products and or their image. So how do you sift these? How do you detect bull?
Mm-hmm.
I have a set of questions that that I ask. There's sort of a bias detector in the book, and those questions are these. First, who is the author? Who's producing this? Who is the sponsor? And are there conflicts that exist between the self-interest of the author or the sponsor and the public interest? So while you're reading something, you need to pay attention to why are they telling me this? What's in it for them? Second question is, what's the purpose of the article? Is it to inform us? Is it to capture our attention for advertisers? Is it to sell us goods or services? Or to fill the news out with something inexpensive like a press release? So you want to think, you know, what's the purpose of the news? So, you know, why did they choose this particular event to cover or this particular issue of all the ones they could have chosen? Why this one? And why choose these particular sources? So the next question is, which groups affected by the issue or event reported are quoted and which are missing? A good way to see who has power in a society is to see who gets quoted. And to look at how prominently they're quoted, how much information comes from one source to another, where those sources are placed in the story. Oftentimes you find that marginalized groups are not quoted at all, and if they are, it's kind of in a position where they're dismissed. They're, you know, mm-hmm. deep in the story, and their quote isn't followed up on by the reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Next question is, what evidence is offered for fact claims? Do they really establish the lead or the premise of the story? Do they check facts? Next, who gains and who loses from the way the story is framed? And framing, as you know, can happen from using certain material but not what you omit, value words, words that are loaded, stereotypes, metaphors, themes, even story structure can bend a story one way or another. And lastly, you can help yourself sometimes now on the web by Googling the story or using Google News or something like that and look at how other media report the same issue or event.
Well, that's...
I explain those things in the book and give examples of how to do that. It's actually work, but I think it's very enlightening, and I'm hoping that those kinds of critical questions will become habits of mind of people rather than something, you know, a checklist they'd have to go through laboriously.
Couldn't agree more. Our guest, John McManus. We've only got a couple minutes left on Media Matters this week. In fact, just about a minute or so. And John, I was just wondering if, for the sake of our listeners, to get a little more concrete again, maybe describe one national story that you think, you know, identifies some of the ways that some BS or bull has gotten. You know, people might give an example of how they could pick up on that.
There are lots of stories. You know, sort of the missing blonde stories that have gotten lots of national attention, but are pretty empty. You know, the case of Shirley Sherrod, the African American woman who whose speech was taken out of context by a conservative blogger and then trumpeted on Fox News, subsequently fired and then rehired when they discovered that she had her statements and her talk to the NAACP had been grossly manipulated, and actually what she said was the opposite of what they reported. There's, you know, you look at a paper almost any day. I was looking at USA Today earlier this week, and the whole front page was about which college football teams are ranked in the top 10.
You know, on that note, I'm afraid, John McManus, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they need to clear me out of the studio. Okay. So I want to thank you so much for taking time from your schedule to join us today on Media Matters. John McManus, author of Detecting Bull. I hope all goes well for you.
It's been a pleasure, Bob.
And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, my producer, Melissa Trentz. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in a week. Our guest in 167 hours, another journalist from the Bay Area, Norman Solomon, joining us for the full hour. So please join us then. And until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll have sunny skies today with a high of 88 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear with a low of 67. Sunny on Monday with a high of 92. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low of 72. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high of 92. And heat index readings ranging between 100 and 105. This is Illinois Public Media, WI.